Hello, welcome back to another going to be incredible show. Episode 35 here of the Capital Spotlight podcast. Your host, Kramer Grother, the Director of Business Development and Lone Star Capital, of course, alongside the one, the only, two-time author, principal and founder, Rob Beardsley. How are you today?
Good. I haven't gotten as much sleep as I'd like the last couple of days, but I'm still full of energy.
Really? Why is that? What are your problems? Walk us through what's keeping you up at night.
So I think what happened is I slept so much and was sleeping so well that instead of accumulating sleep debt, I actually accumulated a sleep surplus, something that our government should learn a trick or two about gaining a surplus as well rather than running a deficit. So I've been
Well,
running
no,
a
they
sleep.
did that in California, and then they lost that lead.
Yeah, well, it is what it is. So I've been running a sleep surplus, it seems like, because I was recovering from being sick and I've just been sleeping a ton. And now I feel like I've slept so much that I'm going to bed early, ready to get a nice long night of sleep. But then I'm just up at 5:30, 6:30, and I can't go back to bed. And so I just end up getting up and going to the gym.
Well, not a bad problem, I suppose, but it would be a problem when you come to the West Coast, which is coming up after your birthday, which everyone go wish Rob a happy birthday. It is February 15th on his birthday, so that will be last Thursday. But everyone go wish and send Rob your best regards and hope you had a great birthday and hope you ate at every single incredible fine dining experience in New York City. Arguably the food capital of the world. Speaking of sleep, speaking of getting better, let's check in on our New Year's resolutions. Where have those been for you? I know I'm a little behind a couple of my things, but let's start with you.
So, if we recall, I think my most important or the thing I was most excited about that we talked about on the show a few months ago or less even was the new habit that I was implementing of leaving my phone in the kitchen an hour before bed, retiring to my bedroom, and having a nice no screen hour before bed to get more sleep, get higher quality sleep, and just I don't need to be scrolling mindlessly, right?
Yeah,
And
the
that.
circadian rhythm gets thrown off when you're aimlessly looking through Instagram reels and TikTok and things of that nature.
So instead of filling my brain with junk, I've been doing a lot more reading, which has been awesome. It's been great to get back into the habit of doing more reading. That's number one. Number two, this habit has gone tremendously well. I've been able to keep it up. I've been able to actually now rewire my brain to actually the habit loop and the dopamine is there for me when I actually do this. Whereas before it was so hard, I would leave my phone in the kitchen and then I would just lay in bed, like wanting to go get my phone. And now I actually. The pleasure sensors are firing when it's like, oh, I leave my phone in the kitchen. This is amazing. I feel good about this. So I would say that that's the number one goal that I've implemented, and it's been going really well. It's been changing my life.
And I've been doing a better job of being respectful of your boundary. Obviously, it's a little bit easier this time of year as Arizona is only 2 hours behind, but I try to not call you anymore after, call it, 9 p.m. my time here, just to respect your 11 p.m. window. And similarly, that will move, ebb, and flow as daylight savings gets switched back up. How are your other goals? How's your red light therapy? How's your meditation? How are the things that you wanted to work on outside of that?
Yeah, so that's the night routine. And then, of course, the night carries into the morning. So now, when I wake up, honestly, most days I wake up to no alarm, which is, I think, I always say the American dream is being able to walk to work and not have an alarm clock. And so basically, just waking up when my body feels like it's time to wake up, that's been going super well. And then also, I don't reach for my phone right as I wake up because that was my old habits. I would wake up, the first thing I would do is grab my phone and get hit with dopamine because I want to see what notifications, who texted me, what Instagram notifications, all that good stuff. And now instead I just wake up more peacefully, more relaxed. I get up, do my thing, and then I go to the red light panel, stand in front of the red light panel, and while I'm taking in the red light, I'm meditating for 10 minutes. So that's been a super great habit and it's killing multiple birds with one stone. And it's really easy to do. And again, I look forward to it and it feels good to check that off the list. It's like I've only been awake for 30 minutes and I've already accomplished so much.
Awesome. So, how are you going to keep up the momentum after the first month and a half of the year, first 2 months after the year is almost one sixth of the way done? What are you going to put into place to make sure that you stay militant on your goals and stay diligent to hit what you want to accomplish this year.
I feel like those habits are pretty much set. And so it's just about maintaining those habits. So as far as those go, I don't really have anything that I'm trying to strive for or reach for. Just something else that I'm working on is just consuming less sugar, which going out to eat and also being addicted to sugar makes it a little bit hard to not do this. But yeah, I think I've been doing all right. Basically, what my rule is now is outside of dinner, I'm not going to consume a dessert or a treat or anything like that, because before we had chocolates in the office, I would walk by and just
Death
grab
trap.
A million chocolates, right? That's unacceptable. So now I'm not going to take sweets away from my life, because why not? I need to enjoy my life. So when I am at a nice dinner and they're serving a really nice dessert, that's part of the experience. So I'm going to let myself have that experience. But outside of that, no dessert, right? And I think that's a fair trade, because before I was not a dessert guy, because I would find it to be, as my dad likes to say lately, grotesque and incomprehensible.
That's his new flavor.
That's his new thing. That's from the scene, I forget what the movie's called, but where he says, "You can't handle the truth." So he says, "I'm sure you think my existence is grotesque and incomprehensible." So anyway, I used to think it was grotesque and incomprehensible to order dessert after having a greedy dinner, but here I am.
Yeah, you've changed. Well, I'm happy that Teddy's ways have implemented into your life with regards to your diet, and that you're going to get back on track. Going into my check-in, I am behind, but what we're going to do, and I'm stating this right now, and these are quick reads or listens, I'm going to pull up what I need to do, which is my books of the months will be these two. I guess we're going to make January the first one and February this one moving forward. So the first book, Multifamily Acquisitions, Developing the Skills to Confidently Analyze and Invest in Multifamily Real Estate, Rob's first book. That's going to be the January book of the month for everyone to follow along with. And then, of course, secondly, Structuring and Raising Debt and Equity for Real Estates. Incredible titles. So I got to get back on those. I'll probably just crank them through Audible once more, get that dialed in. As far as my goal of being under 190 pounds all year, well, I'm at 191 today, unfortunately. I'm going to hold myself accountable here. But good news, because my third goal rolls into the 3-day fast. I'm going to do one quarterly, which I'm going to start the night of Valentine's Day. So that is tomorrow night. I'll start it. And then when you get into town to celebrate your dinner, I think we're going to Thea. Yeah, we're going to Thea that night. So new global investor restaurant there in Phoenix, which I know you're excited for, as am I, as are the team out here, to get dinner there. I will be breaking my 3-day fast with that meal. Maybe I'll have a little protein bar so I don't go full eat the whole menu and eat everything in sight mode. But I will get back down to my allotment. So we'll be back to where we need to be following this week as well.
Okay, that sounds pretty good. I like how that goal ties into your 3-day fast goal, because fasts aren't just for weight loss, right? There's also other health benefits for fasting. So that's nice that they're complementary. And I don't know, have you felt any sort of mind benefits or mood benefits of fasting?
No. I mean, I'll be aware. I mean, you certainly are a lot more sensitive to things, for sure, and you're hyper alert. But I think the biggest thing is it's kind of like, you know, investing money into an account that's a future account. It's investing in something that you're not going to see today, but you know, one way or another, that long term, it's, you know, it's best for you. So when I'm 110 years old and people ask me my secret as to why I've been able to live cancer free, it's like, well, I also started doing, you know, a quarterly 3-day fast for indefinitely. And if I do follow up on that and make that happen, well, there's probably a very good chance that weight maintenance occurs very nicely, and I'll stay sleek and slim and fit into my beautiful new Suit Supply suits, as well as live a healthier and cleaner life.
Love
You're
that.
You're wearing the Rock winter suit right now, by the way. Let's talk about that look, because you have, it looks like a thicker, more flannel-esque material paired with, I believe, the Tom Ford tie, if you want to go through the whole wardrobe right now. And you might as well show the Nautilus too, now that we're
putting me on the
talk.
Spot here. Well, right. So we're having a snow day, and so yeah, it's a particularly wintry day. So I figured that I would wear my flannel wool flannel suit, which this I wouldn't recommend people get as a third, fourth, or fifth suit even necessarily, unless this is a look that they're particularly intrigued by. But this is a flannel where there's texture to the wool. So a lot of people mistakenly think that when they see a wintry suit like this, they go, oh, that's wool. Well, yes, it is wool, but so are all other suits, really. It's just the fact that this is either circular wool or it's wool flannel. So anyhow, it's a very wintry look, making it not appropriate as a, frankly, it's only appropriate, I would say, in the winter, and you can kind of get away with it on worse days in the fall and spring, right? But it's absolutely not a four season suit.
Yeah, you certainly are not going to be wearing that in Dallas or Houston in July or August as we acquire the next incredible opportunity, I would assume, on site. That would be a very heavy wear for you there.
Yes, that's correct. And then also, the camera may not pick this up exactly, but this is a nice textured tie as well. It's got a little bit of a winter vibe as well. So I thought I'd go all out with the winter look today, given the wintry snow day that we've gotten. Snow's cleared up now. So yeah, that's the outfit for the office today.
Very good. And if you're wondering what is new with my house, here is the closet that I just built. It's a little bit tough to sell. It's harsh, but we added an office in this bedroom here because we are potentially looking to get a healthy IRR and exit here of my personal residence. So that's the update here. And speaking of being in Houston, speaking of going to Texas, let's go to Texas, metaphorically speaking, and let's get into the fund-to-fund document potentially for our newest acquisition. If you want to lead the way and share the screen there, and we'll dive through kind of some mechanics here. We want to always show, you know, what's in it for you if you're a fund manager and capital raiser. And this is my call to action for the day. If you are looking to raise money for any multifamily opportunities, if you're an LP investor looking to safely park your cash in a great deal, if you have a 1031 exchange in the future, please let Rob and myself know. You can find me, of course, at craig@lscre.com. Once more, craig@lscre.com. If you're looking to work with us on any deals, opportunities to place capital. Now walk us through what's going on here.
Yeah, so here I've pulled up the Portland Copperleaf underwriting model. And now this investment opportunity that we have under contract is a 506B opportunity. So we are not doing a public solicitation for investment. This investment is may or may not be open for investment. We're not soliciting. We're not selling anything here. If you want to learn more about investing with Lone Star, like Craig said, please reach out to him and we're happy to speak with you on a one-on-one basis after we create a substantive relationship per the rules and guidelines of a Regulation D 506B offering. So with that being said, here
we
have...
said it better myself.
I've got some practice. So here we have the Cortland Copperleaf underwriting. And what we wanted to do today is Craig and I had to, we're going to discuss and put together the fund-to-fund underwriting model to share with our partners on this deal. And then Craig had the genius idea to why not we just do it on the podcast. And I love that idea. So here we are. So super simple, actually. But like I said, this is the base underwriting. And so the base underwriting has all of our assumptions in here. And in particular, what we're going to focus on today is it has the waterfall for this deal. And so as you can see, this deal has our generic terms and structure. So we have an 8% cumulative and compounding preferred return, followed by a 30% promote up to a 15% IRR. And then above that 15% IRR, there's a 50% promote. So there's a 50-50 split between the sponsor and investors. And so, of course, this just flows through the waterfall, and that's how we generate the returns net of fees and net of promote for investors. But what we're talking about today is actually the fund-to-fund model. And so here we have basically all I did was copy and pasted the file and opened up a new file and added fund-to-fund to the name. So the file is now named Cortland Copperleaf UW FOF. But what we're going to do now is make some tweaks for our fund-to-fund partners. Super simple. So the way that that works is, and also this is not set in stone, so we change our terms for our fund-to-fund partners on a deal-by-deal basis, just given the economics of the deal and the profile. And so that's why we have to go through this together and make decisions as far as what the deal profile is going to look like. And just spoiler alert, we've already kind of discussed this and looked at this previously, so there's not going to be really much of a brainstorm here, but we're going to share with you the process anyhow. So
and sometimes people do, you know, tune into different episodes. So if this is boring and you've gone through this, feel free to skip this segment. If you haven't, well, this is obviously informational and valuable. So
yeah, or if what we're talking about is totally foreign to you and you don't even know what a fund to fund is, then we absolutely invite you to check out the fund to fund webinar that we hosted and have recorded and posted on our YouTube channel. So head over to our YouTube channel. You can just type in Rob Beardsley, Lone Star Capital on YouTube, fund to fund, and you'll see a whole hour long video where we covered the whole fund to fund program. And also if you reach out to Craig, he can just send that video to you along with our fund to fund just a two-page document there. So what we do here is we reduce the acquisition fee to 1.5% from 2% for fund-to-fund partners. And so fund-to-fund partners have $1 million minimum. So basically, fund-to-fund partner is going to aggregate $1 million. And then they're going to invest that $1 million as a single check into the deal. And because they're bringing capital at scale, that's why we're willing to give a discount on the acquisition fee and give improved economics on the waterfall. And so that's the main element here, is the reduction in the acquisition fee. Now we're going to move over to the waterfall tab and talk about the changes to the waterfall. So as we just went over in the standard document or the standard underwriting model, we have the 8% pref, 30% promote, 50 split above 15. Well, the fund-to-fund partners are very lucky indeed because they get a 9% preferred return instead of that 8. And then there's a straight 20% promote thereafter. So there's no secondary hurdle. That's why it's just a straight 20 over the 9. And what that does is it improves the returns to the fund-to-fund, which then allows that fund-to-fund partner who raised the capital into that special purpose vehicle or single purpose entity to charge fees at their sub-entity, at their fund-to-fund level, and to charge their own waterfall or to implement their own promote at the fund-to-fund level so that the net of fees returns at the fund-to-fund level is roughly commensurate, competitive with investing directly into the deal. We don't want to disincentivize their investors to invest through their fund-to-fund and try to circumvent that and invest directly with us. Obviously, we want to protect our partners and protect their interest, which is, of course, maintaining the relationships with their investors. So with that,
the last thing we want to do is set up an ecosystem where people can just get circumvented and just go to us because we get better economics. We want to level the playing field to make sure that it is all fair and equal and you get compensated for bringing your incredible investors into our world-class opportunity.
Absolutely. So now that we've covered the deal level promote structure, right? We've enhanced it for the fund to fund and we've reduced the acquisition fee. Now we're going to go through the waterfall and we're going to do something nifty. This is top secret stuff. We're actually going to reveal these hidden cells here, these hidden rows. And what they reveal is the fund to fund module in our underwriting document, in our model. So here we have a $1 million raise. And again, so this is the nuance here because what you see in blue are inputs. And these are inputs that we don't determine. We're not forcing our fund-to-fund partners to charge a certain fee or to have a certain structure. It's just a guideline. It's a recommendation. But as a fund manager, you can charge whatever fees you want to your investors. But what we do is we kind of set a standard and we say, hey, this is what we think makes the most sense for you to charge, and we'll explain why. So what we have here is the minimum for the fund to fund, which is $1 million. That's the raise amount. Then we have a DD fee that we recommend our fund to fund partners charge to the deal. So that's effectively a $20,000 fee that they'll be able to earn for themselves for raising $1 million. And then what we don't frankly recommend a fund to fund to charge an asset management fee because it just creates a drag on cash flow, which is very difficult to make up. And as we all know, investors are very sensitive to cash flow. And so we don't want to penalize and make cash flow worse than it needs to be. So foregoing an asset management fee, we think makes sense in this scenario. Moving over to the waterfall. Now, again, this is not the deal level waterfall. This is the fund to fund level waterfall. So at the fund to fund level, in this case, we recommend, you know what? And I forget what we recommend because I'm starting from scratch. So I'm actually going to look and see what we recommend here. So we recommend, I think, a 15% promote over an 8. And that is going to get, I'm jumping ahead here, but this is literally live, the thought process that I have to go through and that Craig and I have to go through to figure this stuff out. So if our fund-to-fund partners charge a 15% promote over an 8 and they get their 2% DD fee, then going through the waterfall, this calculates that the fund-to-fund manager is projected to make 11.9% on the capital that they raise, which is within our strike zone. We're generally looking to target a 10 to 14% compensation all in over the 5-year investment period for our fund-to-fund managers. I didn't come up with that. That's just what the market demands. And, you know, frankly, we've had people who we've offered essentially this structure and they're projected to make 12% of what they raise. And they go, oh, well, someone else is offering me 14 or 15. And it's, hey, sorry, if someone's willing to pay you more for the money that you're raising, then if that's what you're optimizing for, then that makes sense. But what we're looking to be is a competitive partner where you can make a good profit for your raising capital services and abilities, but also we are recognizing or hoping that our partners recognize that they're partnering with a best-in-class sponsor. So we don't want to win. We don't want to compete necessarily on price. We do want to be competitive, obviously, and be responsive to the market.
Well, and another thing to think about too is we feel very confident with our deals, and every sponsor offers different returns or projected returns, I should say, so on and so forth, and for different risk buckets, right? And be very careful if someone who's willing to pay you or willing to pay you more on the front end, with realizing that if the deal doesn't actually perform well, you're making, you know, 100% of nothing theoretically. So to give up a bit more of the pie, frankly, or theoretically in the front end to have us manage the opportunity to source the deal, so on and so forth, is probably within your best interest. You know, chasing the highest return on the front end is a fool's errand, in my opinion. You go though. But of course, what's in it for me? I understand that I'm a capitalist. I like to, of course, on my end, make as much money as possible. And we want our partners to make as much money as possible, but we all need to eat together while also having our investors' interest at mind. Back to you.
Yeah, no, that's actually really well said, what you said about you could get a percentage of nothing, right, if the deal goes south. And so that's really important to keep in mind. And like they say, a great manager, a great sponsor can make an okay deal great, and a bad sponsor can make a great deal bad. So it's all about betting on the jockey, not the horse. I think I got that analogy right. So anyhow, this is what we'll be recommending to our fund-to-fund partners. And what we also need to do, so what we've done now is we've sanity checked the return or the compensation to the fund-to-fund manager, right? And so it checks out 11.9%. That's within our strike zone. That's what we're willing to offer to our partners. And our partners should be excited about that because that's in market. So, but with the other end of the spectrum is we have to sanity check whether those numbers or whether the structure makes sense for the fund-to-fund investors. And so the way we do that is we look at the projected returns for the fund-to-fund LPs. So here are those projections right here. So you can see we have a 15.8% projected LP IRR for investors investing into this fund-to-fund sub-entity, a 1.99x equity multiple, and a 5.7% cash-on-cash. So if we take that and compare it to the investing directly, you can see that we're projecting, if you invest directly, a 15.9% IRR and a 6% cash on cash and a 2x equity multiple. So the numbers are very close. They're not quite there. I would say the cash on cash is the biggest difference, right? There's a 30 basis point difference in average cash on cash. So that makes me a little bit concerned because I don't want our partners being nervous about, hey, my investors, I'm only able to offer them 5.7 and you're offering your investors directly a 6. So there's, unfortunately, with the cash on cash, there's not a whole lot that we can do to change that. One thing is obviously the partner can charge a lower due diligence fee and that brings the cash on cash up, but obviously our partners want to get paid. So that's something to be aware of. The other thing that's possible is we can look to give the fund-to-fund a higher IRR to compensate them for the potentially low cash on cash. So those are the toggles, the things that we can play around with. But at the end of the day, I think that this is close enough to the base deal returns. So I don't think we necessarily have to tweak it any further, but it's something that our team may opt to change if we feel like it's necessary.
Well done. Anything else you want to add to the Cortland Fund of Fund document or anything else you would like to mention regarding the deal? It does look like you and Brad have beaten this one up a bit, brought it down. I noticed that interest only period went to 1 year. I see obviously the cap rate exiting it at 6% seems to be very conservative in nature. What else should be aware of that changed on the underwriting here?
Yeah, we made this deal more conservative just because we feel like we want to under-promise and over-deliver, right? That's a recurring theme. So even though we had originally underwritten this deal with a little bit more aggressive numbers or higher returns, we feel like it's better to go to investors and project lower returns and do it that way. So what we did is we increased the concessions non-revenue from 0.5% to 1%. So basically, we reduced the revenue projection just a touch. We increased payroll, because while our management team gave us a certain payroll budget that is a bit lower than this, we felt that we should just run with a bit higher of a payroll. We also increased repairs and maintenance a touch.
I see debt went up 10 bips.
We also, yes, in light of the recent treasury run, we increased our interest rate. We should hopefully come inside this, but that is a wish, and we're not going to bank on rates coming down prior to closing, right? And then obviously we were optimistically hoping to get 2 years of IO, but Freddie's really cracking down on 5-year deals, and so it looks like we might only get 1 year of IO, which is a bummer, but it's not the end of the world. So we beefed up some other expenses like marketing and admin costs because it's just good to be conservative on expenses. We've got a pretty conservative insurance estimate, in my opinion, here at $1,400 per unit. So anyway, that's where we're at on the
and underwriting. When we're looking through this, and I'm just thinking about this, I feel pretty confident we're going to come inside of that debt number with it being 6.1. I feel like we're going to, you know, beat some of the metrics here for sure, which is exciting. I'd rather beat these items as opposed to, you know, losing them. So I feel very confident in that. And just this makes us deal more conservative. And, you know, we want to attract better investors who want to see lower returns. So hopefully those listening here and those who are interested in working with us, I recognize that and want us to underpromise and overdeliver, and realizing that the value in here is just investing in a safe deal. With that said, excitingly, bonus depreciation might be coming back to 100%. As we know, the Trump administration, of course, brought in accelerated depreciation to do 100% bonus depreciation in the first year, offering incredible incentives for those who invest in the space. Now, of course, with the sunsetting, of course, in 2023, it was 80%. In 2024, it's scheduled to be theoretically 60%. It seems, though, that we may change the tax code just before tax season is due here to reinstate 100% bonus depreciation. Is that my understanding? Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, so that bill that contains that change, it passed through the House, and it's, I think, working its way through the Senate. So it's not a done deal, but that would be very, very big news for the commercial real estate industry, which could definitely use a lift, as spirits haven't been the highest lately, with performance kind of slowing down and with interest rates rising. So that would be a really great thing. We historically have always taken advantage of doing a cost segregation analysis and electing bonus depreciation, which has really juiced up our losses, our paper losses for our investors. So yeah, 100% coming back would be huge.
Kind of funny. I think every single time you're like, oh, you're doing a cost segregation study. It's like, are you serious? Like we wouldn't do that. Like, it's almost like an offensive question that, like, we wouldn't do that. Like, why would we ever not do a cost segregation study? Can you actually give me like a logical reason as to why anyone would not? And I'm like, I'm being genuinely serious here, because it's like, do you think we're mentally challenged?
The only reason why you wouldn't do it is if the cost of the asset was so low that the cost of a cost segregation study was high relative to your equity and your your cost of the asset. But the reality is, I was at a conference and this guy went on stage and was talking. He was pitching basically his services, and his company does cost seg reports for like $600. So, I mean, if you have a rental, a single family rental property that's worth $700,000, a $600, $800 cost seg report is worth it, right? But a $5,000 cost seg report, it's not really that as much worth it, right? But if you're talking less than $1,000, so they're pretty much, I think these days, absolutely zero scenario where it would make sense to have to not do a cost seg.
100%, no pun intended. And with that said, that was kind of funny. With that said, I definitely think that there's no mystery as to why this is being brought back. I think that anytime an administration is rerunning for election, we like to pull any trigger possibly economically to pump some money back into it. Like Michael Jordan once famously said, Republicans buy sneakers too. Turns out Democrats also own real estate, and they likely probably want to bring that back to incentivize their, you know, representative Joe Biden, if he's electing or going back for re-election, to pump up the economy there. Obviously, it's not a little known secret that the commercial real estate space is having some headwinds right now with debt maturities coming up. So I think if you cut interest rates, which everyone is kind of assuming that they're going to do, and taking home to the bank that that's occurring, coupled with 100% bonus depreciation, you can artificially pump this market back up, pull a couple strings and levers, and get people feeling excited and good again, and have velocity return, rego, which will just only jumpstart the economy. So I do think that they're looking to pull the strings and levers they can accordingly to make things work. Any way you slice it, if that's what they want to do, I'm all for it. Bring back 100% bonus depreciation. Hey, bring back 200% bonus depreciation. Create that. I don't care, but that would be awesome. But that's kind of my theory. And I've thought about this for some time, that I knew this would kind of come back. And I always say, hey, real estate and energy, one way or another, they will always be maybe opening up loopholes, closing the loopholes, and creating a new one. And this is just re-extending, hopefully and theoretically, 100% bonus depreciation to avoid theoretically a maturity crisis with debt.
Yeah, so depreciation or 100% bonus depreciation, one thing it does is it incentivizes transactions. Because if you know that by buying a piece of real estate, you're going to generate a huge paper loss for yourself that you're going to then be able to use to offset income or gains elsewhere in your portfolio, that's a big incentive to buy the real estate outside of the benefits that it provides directly. Economically,
maybe you're gonna start selling stocks. Maybe you've got, you know, some gains over here that you want to sell, you want to free up, you want to liquidate, and you could roll them into another sector. You know, theoretically, if you're not a real estate professional, and I'm not a tax advisor in that nature, but let's say if you owned a bunch of Apple stock and you sold that and you've got, you know, capital gains there, then you invest into a syndication like ours and be in receipt of some bonus depreciation to offset that gain there. So there's a lot of maneuvering that can go on that could be theoretically very accretive, and it's most accretive in the real estate space. Obviously, oil and gas more, but higher risk, hence the return profile. But it is just incredibly beneficial if it does get reinstated.
Yep. So, and we all know that transaction activity has been way down. So with 100% bonus depreciation possibly back, that would help spur transaction activity to come back up a little bit. But I don't think that's kind of like, what do they say? That's kind of like fixing a light bulb on the sinking Titanic, right? Like, I think commercial real estate sector has bigger problems than bonus depreciation. I think those problems are going to have to be worked out, and reinstating 100% bonus is not going to fix that.
Well, thank you for the newest phrase that I'll be incorporating into my vernacular here moving forward. Fixing a light bulb on the Titanic. I think that's just brilliant. Very good. Well, hopefully they do bring that back, because that would actually totally retransform how we're probably going to be distributing our K-1s for our investors for 2023 deals, as well as 2024, if theoretically that comes into play. And just from a significance perspective, Rob, just for instance, the deal in Cortland, right? Theoretically, if it was at the sunsetting 60% slated right now, as opposed to 100% bonus depreciation, tangibly speaking, what does that mean to the investor who invests $100,000? With how it currently sets up right now, what would someone get if it's at 60% versus 100% accelerated depreciation?
Yeah, so it would be, I'm just running some quick.
You want to
math.
Share your screen so people can
No,
figure
I'm
out
just
the
I'm just doing some
okay
back of napkin stuff, and I'm a little insecure about my math skills, so I don't want to share my screen.
You don't have, did you bring your abacus to your office today?
No, I didn't bring it.
Nah, that's why.
So, based on my back of napkin here, which don't hold me to it, it looks like based on 2024's current schedule, which is 60% bonus depreciation. And also, we didn't really explain what bonus is. So let me just explain it really quickly. So with a cost segregation analysis, you have an engineer come to the property. And what they do is they account for all items and they literally segregate out the value of all the items of an asset, the roofs, the parking lot, the appliances, the doors, everything. And they put those different items into buckets. They put them into 5-year useful life buckets and then 15-year useful life buckets. So something like a oven stove range would have a 5-year useful life, and then the roofs might have a 15-year useful life. But the benefit of bonus depreciation is instead of doing accelerated depreciation where you can depreciate those individual items of the property on those respective 5-year and 15-year schedules, you can actually just take the totality of the depreciation associated with those 5-year and 15-year items and just take all that depreciation in year one. So that's how 100% bonus depreciation works. Now, in 2024, we only have 60% bonus depreciation. So that means we can take 60% of those of the totality of the of that depreciation in year one. So based on my math here for Cortland, just as an example deal, it looks like if an investor invests in the deal, they can get about 30-ish cents of depreciation for every invested dollar, right? So they get 30% of their investment in year one depreciation. So if they invest 100K, they can expect their 2024 K1 to come back with a $30,000 loss. Now, if 100% bonus were to come back, then that would juice up that loss factor up to 55%. So you would get 55 cents of depreciation for every investment dollar.
Incredible. So you see the delta there is pretty large, and it is something to think about. The importance of these levers being pulled, and you know, you can think about the crosshairs and the reasonings why they may or may not want to do this, but anyway, slice it, don't really care what the reasoning behind it is for their own best interests. If it's, you know, if you're thinking it from a political perspective, I just want it to come back any form in any way, shape, because as Schmoth once famously said on the All In podcast, seemingly the biggest winners of the COVID run were the real estate investors who could utilize 100% bonus depreciation. And he is 100% correct. With that said, and speaking of bonus depreciation and financial matters, we just hired a new controller. So Rob, do you want to talk about Dan and kind of what that, the reasoning behind it is, what he will do and kind of his roles there?
Yeah, 100%. So really excited to bring Dan onto the team. I'm sure at some point he will become a little more public facing as he gets
acclimated
into the firm and whatnot. And perhaps he could even be a guest on the show at some point. But Dan is our new controller, and a controller is basically the level in between a CFO, your chief financial officer, and your accounting team. So a controller really is kind of just a step below the CFO. And so we've been in dire need of somebody to fill this position because there's obviously a lot of things going on from an accounting standpoint, from a cash management standpoint, from making payments, making transfers, putting money into escrows, making sure we have enough money raised from investors to be able to close the deal on time, and all this kind of stuff, accounting for advancements and disbursements and payments and stuff like that. So it's all the stuff that's really not sexy, not very often talked about, but it's some really great firepower. And Dan comes over to us from Related, which is one of the country's biggest real estate companies, a really fantastic company. I actually just finished reading a great book called The New Kings of New York, which tells the tales of some of the marquee developers of New York City. And of course, one of those names is Steve Ross, the founder of Related, who is the developer behind Hudson Yards, which was the largest private development in U.S. history. So related, they're the real deal. Dan, he's the real deal. So super excited to have him on board.
He was a first choice too, if I'm not mistaken, which is always nice to get who you want in these searches, as typically we are a product of nepotism, I believe, for our hiring. However, we did cast a wide net here and yielded the best fruit we could possibly get. So welcome, Dan. We're excited to have him be a part of the team. And just so everyone else can understand, is he kind of replacing some of Kent's hours, would you say, as opposed to yours? Is he basically going to be what I am to you? How would you say what I am to you as he is to Kent? You know, how will he float there? Will he take some burden and stress off your plate? I mean, inevitably he's going to if Kent's more free. And the goal is to make sure Kent gets an extra at least 10 hours back of the week to think about, you know, how we can grow the firm revenue and just make sure, you know, our asset and property management is humming and firing all cylinders. But where will he play? Whose life will he free up and whose time will he be saving?
Yeah. First and foremost, Kent's. So Kent has been kind of the one that's the buck stops with him for a lot of these responsibilities. And so a running joke that Kent and I have had for the last, I mean, honestly, 6 months. No, not that long. Maybe 3 months as we've, once we made the decision to hire a controller, and this is months ago, we just found over and over again all these instances where we had to do something or we had a headache pop up that would have been handled by a controller. So Kent bumps into an issue and he goes to me, we should hire a controller. Right. So every time we have an issue now, it's like, oh, we need a controller. It's like, yeah, I know we need a controller. So we've just been encountering many things. So he does have a lot of responsibilities related to treasury, cash management, accounting, things like that. So he oversees a ton of stuff. So the goal here would be, like you said, to be able to get back maybe 10 hours per week of Kent's time. That'd be super valuable. So he can be more on top of things that are more accretive to the company value, to the portfolio value, to investors, like working on more affordable housing strategies, working on improving the performance of the portfolio and things like that. So yeah, first and foremost, definitely helps him out. It will help me out as well because I have to sign certain things or move certain money because I'm one of the few people that have those access to the bank accounts and things like that. So yeah, it's going to be helpful. I wouldn't say it's going to be as game changing as bringing you on, helping me, just because you've really...
Well, nothing could be, of course.
Right, exactly. Nothing can be as game changing as bringing you onto the team. That would be amazing. If we could find something like that, like for Kent, that would just be incredible. Then he could be on a beach somewhere relaxing, right? So yeah, it's not going to be quite at that level where you've stepped up and just really taken over a ton of my responsibilities, which has been huge. It's not going to be quite the same, but maybe it will be. I don't know. We'll see.
It could evolve into that. You just never know, right? Because like you're kind of grooming me to basically be you. I mean, I'm not going to be able to go on a stage all of a sudden and you know, all of a sudden lose my stage fright. But I can go into these conversations, know the structuring, know how to rip up a term sheet, know how to sift through that and basically let you make the final choice as it's, of course, not my firm, but yours. Well, the people's, the investors, right? But nevertheless, it would be incredible to have someone kind of step up there where you and Kent can just focus full time on how do you really put out the best strategy? How are you networking with the highest leverage stakes possible? How are you doing that? So if we could find out a way in which you and Kent can run those races and let myself and a Dan and maybe someone else or, you know, whatnot, kind of come in there and lighten your guys' load and, you know, be more public facing and take care of those things. The sky's the limit for what we can obviously accomplish.
Yeah. Super exciting. So super exciting to grow the firm methodically, not be in a situation where we have to hire frantically, right? Because we're scaling so quickly, right? We're growing at a good pace, but not at a pace that's unsustainable or causing us to make mistakes. You know, it's actually interesting. I'm reading a book right now all about hiring and promoting. And the research, according to this book, says that only like basically when people make a hire, they basically get the hire right 25% of the time. So 75% of the time, people are hiring the wrong person and it doesn't work out. Only 25% of the time are people hiring A players. And so I would say that one of the most exciting things about our firm and this is just a requirement if you want to be a good firm, is you need to have 90% A players. That's what the book says, and I totally believe it. I mean, our people are our number one asset. And so how do you get good people? Well, you have to hire them, right? And so hiring is a skill in itself. So I'm reading this book and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so much more to hiring. And we've gotten lucky because we've just kind of accidentally stumbled into hiring amazing people. But after reading this book, I'm equipped. I'm not finished with it yet, but I'm equipping myself with the tools and capabilities to actually have the skills to hire A players. According to this book, if I follow this book, I can go from 25% hiring A players to a 90% success rate. So that sounds good to me.
Well, let's talk about two things there, and I would actually love to unpack that more. Question number one is, what are the new things that you look for there, I guess, regarding, you know, what makes a positive hire?
Well, okay, so yeah, so the way this book breaks it down is basically you've got A players, B players, and C players. And obviously the book explains what those three categories look like, but I think we all know what we're looking at when we see it. When we see an A player, we see a self-starter. I would say the number one word, let me see if I can remember it. Basically, there's all these characteristics of an A player, but it boils down to one word. And if I'm remembering correctly, it's basically resourcefulness. Right? How capable is that person and self-motivated to encounter problems and overcome them on their own, rather than just go, oh, this broke, I don't know how to do it, help me, right? That's a B player or maybe even a C player, right? And so A players are really what take you to the next level. And this hiring methodology is basically a much more rigorous process of, you don't just look at someone's resume, you actually really dig into their high school education, if you have if time permits, right? You dig into the high school, to the college, to every step, every job, and you ask about, why did you take this job? Why did you leave this job, right?
Thank God I got the backdoor entrance into Lone Star.
No, I know. The way that this hiring process is laid out in this book is insanely rigorous. Like every job you have to talk about what, not just what you thought about the job, but what you think your boss would say about your strengths and weaknesses in that job. And then importantly, they say the most important step is actually saying, hey, set up a call with that boss, that former boss, because we want to talk to them and actually hear from them about you. And that's where they say you get the most value, is actually getting those reference checks, and not just a reference check like, oh, hey, Craig, you put Teddy on your reference check. And I call Teddy and Teddy says, yeah, I worked with Craig. Craig is great, right? Like these are legit reference checks. And this book says that basically B and C players, when they see, oh, I'm going to have to actually provide legitimate reference checks, they run away. They just completely eject themselves out from the hiring process.
Yeah, they basically disqualify themselves before they can get put on trial.
Exactly. Exactly right. So this book is super good. I'm reading this book, and as I'm reading it, I've already told Kent, hey, you've got to read it. And by now, I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, well, what is this book called? And I don't want to tell you because I don't want to give away my competitive advantage, right? It's a secret. These are my skills. I want to hire the best people.
Me.
But in all seriousness, the book is called Top Grading. It's so far, I'm halfway through. So far, it's a super good book. The guy who wrote the book is actually, he's said he's conducted 6,500 of these sorts of interview processes. And he was also the hiring advisor to Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE, and who Jack Welch was at the time admired as the best CEO in the country. So anyway, that was a bit of a tangent, but super exciting stuff.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for the color there. And I guess just, you know, when, and this is my second question, when does a firm like ours, or just a firm generally, need to think about adding a controller? Is there a certain unit size, a certain unit count? I mean, obviously everyone's different. Everyone wants to, you know, work more or less as they see fit. But where does it really come into play where it makes a lot of sense to bring someone on of his caliber with his prestige and background to help us grow and to achieve what we need?
I think there's a lot of factors at play. Given that we are vertically integrated, has a factor. When vertically integrated means we have property management, construction management in-house. So we have more moving parts that come under our direct purview. And even when you have third-party property management, you really still need to be on top of them as well. Just because they're not your technical employees, you really need to hound them to get good performance. So there's no easy answer. But the other major factor here for us as well is the fact that we brought accounting in-house starting 2024. So that was a big shift for us and a super exciting shift because it not only is reducing our accounting costs, it's also, we're already seeing it in real time. It's also increasing the speed and effectiveness of our accounting. Because once you get to a certain size, outsourcing your accounting to a third-party firm becomes more costly than just bringing it in-house. Obviously, if you just have a couple properties, then you can't hire a full-time accountant to just do a couple deals. That doesn't make sense. So we're now at that scale. We have 3,500 units in the portfolio. We have in-house accounting. And of course, when you have in-house accounting, you need to oversee that accounting function. And a controller is what does that. So that helps in our situation, or that is more necessary in our situation. But I would say the controller, I mean, you could even say we were a little bit late to the game as far as hiring a controller, given our growth and our size. But it really just depends on people's hiring style. Some people hire before the need, and some people hire at the need or after the need, right? And so if you hire before the need, you're basically hiring people in anticipation of that demand. And so when you hire them, there's going to be slack in the firm's capacity. And so I think that's a good way to go if you anticipate growth and you're confident in that growth and you have the capital to invest in that growth, right? Because what that means is you're hiring people before you really need them. So you're spending that extra money and you're probably, you know, you have less revenue to actually afford them. So we've been hiring, I'd say, kind of like at the need, if not a little bit after the need. So we kind of get really busy, we realize there's a problem, and then we fix it with the hire, and then we move on and grow from there. And I think that's a really good way to go, because that means when you hire someone, you really actually know that you need them. And you're not just hiring somebody new because it makes you feel good, because you're growing headcount, or it feels like you're doing something productive, it feels like you're growing the company, right? You're actually hiring someone who's going to plug in and create real value.
I love that. Perfect. Well, that said, speaking of financial needs, speaking of maneuvering, speaking of exits, entrance is one point and whatnot, we may potentially sell a deal later this year. So, you know, what does a sale look like for us? And do we 1031 exchange it at that point? And how does it work with promote? So can you kind of lead the way as to where your head lands when I ask a question like that, please?
Yeah, really excited about this topic, because I don't want to give away too much information or get some of our investors' hopes up. I don't know. Kent might get mad.
You're jumping the shark.
Kent might get mad if we share too much information, right, and all that. But anyway, so yeah, let's just say hypothetically we do sell a deal later this year.
Potentially.
We would. So basically our general strategy is upon selling an asset, we look to 1031 exchange that entity, the ownership entity of that deal. And so what that means is, let's say we bought the deal and we used $10 million of equity to buy the deal. And let's say the deal went great. And so we have $15 million of equity at that point. And so we look to take that entity level entity. I'd say, you know, I'm not explaining it well, but the ownership entity. And we look to 1031 exchange the entire ownership entity. Now, on an individual basis, investors can elect to participate in that entity level exchange, or they can decide to just opt out and take their sale proceeds in cash. And then what we would have to do at that point is bring in fresh investor capital to plug that gap to fulfill that upleg or the new acquisition. So that will be 100% our intention if and when we do sell an asset later this year. And that will be a really exciting thing, because I think that'll be a big win, because getting a good sale out of this market is very rare. And so we have a unique situation here that could potentially create such an opportunity. And the beauty and exciting thing about that is we'll be able to sell and then reinvest those gains into a very attractive
profit. Yeah, at a profit in a distressed time into a new opportunity. It's really just, you know, multifaceted in that regard, frankly. The benefits these investors would be in receipt of to sync up everything with that alignment is truly going to be a special, special thing for them.
Being able to reinvest into this market where there's really great opportunities is super exciting. So the other thing,
Yeah, I was about to ask with Promote, which it sounds like you're probably about to segue into.
Yeah, so Promote, I think, is a super cool concept when it comes to selling and 1031 exchanging because, and again, I'm not a CPA and I'm not giving tax advice, so I could be totally wrong. But with Promote, what's exciting is when you sell, right? So Promote is the sponsor performance compensation that is earned upon sale, generally speaking. So let's say we do well on this deal and we earn a promote. So let's just say Lone Star Capital gets, let's say, $1 million of promote upon sale on this deal. Well, instead of taking that $1 million promote in cash, creating a tax liability for us and recognizing it as income, what we can do is we can earn that promote by way of ownership in the upleg, in the new acquisition. And that $1 million of promote interest can be exchanged and turned into LP interest, which actually is essentially a hard equity investment at that point, which generates monthly cash flow and distributions to Lone Star Capital at that point. And that is super exciting because it's a double shielder tax strategy because we are deferring, recognizing that income and able to actually defer it through the 1031 exchange. And then we're investing it into the new deal, which again is going to generate bonus depreciation for us, either at 60% or 100% or whatever it is. So we're creating new losses for ourselves through that reinvestment. And then of course, we're creating cash flow for ourselves through that reinvestment as well. So I think that's a really exciting thing for sponsors to be able to take advantage of and structure properly. And then the partners of ours that co-GP with us, that raise capital and get GP ownership, they're able to then roll and take that promote that they earn and then roll it into the next deal as well.
I love it. Well, all exciting there. Hopefully we can connect all those dots. We can align everything accordingly and correctly to make sure that we can utilize the best tax strategies possible. And also more significant than just, well, I guess not more significant, but also and very important to note too, is that if we theoretically sell this deal, that will be three exits for us. Hopefully another exit next year, getting us closer to over the 5 mark mile point, if you will. And then once you're over 10, it's, you know, even that much better. But we look really forward to flipping through some of these deals with a positive result for our investors, especially in a distressed period right now. The net gain is just going to be really, really special. Finally, this is your birthday week, and we've been sitting on this topic for a while. We haven't gotten to it, but can you walk us through the restaurants you're going to this week with your family? And then also one of your new favorite apps, Belly, the Belly app, which gives you reviews, will give you an insight if you're a traveler in any city, where is, I believe, probably America only, but I'm sure there's some international amenities associated there to figure out good restaurants. But what restaurants are you hitting this week? Belly, Belly reviews, your breakdown of Belly. Kind of walk us through that all.
Yeah, let me start with Belly because it's so cool and it's really amplified my interest in restaurants and dining out and stuff like that, which is a more recent hobby, if you can call it that, for myself. So it's been fun ride, and to substantiate it and to justify it as a hobby, I've even read Setting the Table by Danny Meyer recently, which is, Danny Meyer is a very well-known, very successful restaurateur behind 11 Madison Park, Urban, I'm just drawing a blank, but Tabla, The Modern, which I dined at last week actually for my grandma's birthday. And then he's also, of course, behind Shake Shack, which is his commercial success. So anyway, read that book, Setting the Table. So got a more inside scoop on restaurants and all that stuff. So the Belly app is super cool. And also to your point about international, the thing about Belly is it's just hooked up to Google Maps. So any place that exists on Google Maps can be entered into your Belly and be ranked. And so
seamless integration.
It's really nice. And so the way Belly works is basically you just type in a restaurant. If it exists on Google Maps, it'll exist in Belly. And then you can say, hey, I've eaten here. And then it'll say, okay, well, did you like it? Was it okay? Or did you not like it? And you say, oh, well, I liked it. And then it'll say, okay, great. Then it will match it up head to head against other restaurants that are in your rankings. that you've also liked. And then I'll say, okay, well, is this sushi restaurant better than that sushi restaurant? And then you'll basically pick and choose and say, well, I like this one more. I like this one more. And it makes you make all these tough decisions. And through these head-to-head rankings of different restaurants, it basically ranks your favorites from top to bottom, and it'll give it a position in your rankings, like, oh, this is your seventh favorite restaurant. And then it'll also ascribe a numerical ranking to the restaurant as well. So, oh, this is your seventh favorite restaurant, and it's a 9.6 rating for you. So once you put in enough data about your restaurant preferences and favorites and stuff, then this app, Belly, B-E-L-I, will start generating recommendations for you through the algorithm. It says, okay, well, based on the 100 restaurants you put in, we think you'll like this restaurant. We think you'd give this restaurant 8.6. So it's really satisfying and interesting to go to a new restaurant and then check and see, oh, well, Belly thinks I would give this an 8.5. And then you eat there. And then in the end, you put it in. And again, you don't write 8.5 ranking. You don't give it the numerical ranking. It gives you your numerical ranking by you entering it into your list and comparing it head to head. So it's a super fun app, which helps you keep track. Because honestly, you can lose track of all the restaurants you've been to and you don't really remember the experience and stuff like that. So it makes you more mindful about going out and stuff like that. So yeah, that's the Belly app. I don't know. I invited you to it, but I don't think you really dove into it much.
Not too much, but it is something popular and something I should definitely, you know, sort to do. Unfortunately, what happens when I travel is the following. I'm either with you or I'm maybe in Phoenix eating. I know where I'm going to eat in Phoenix. If I'm traveling out and about, you'd usually have you dial up the Atlas card and you'll sort out an incredible reservation there. Or if I'm in Europe, like doing something like that. I watch so much YouTube travel videos. Like my YouTube content is legitimately like Colin Cowherd takes, travel food spots, different country videos, you know, travel vlogs. I think in another life, I might've been a travel vlogger or a professional football GM, because that's seemingly the only things I really like to do is work, workout, travel videos, traveling, and watching pro football. So I'm the most simple man in America, and sprinkle a little golf in here and there. And that's all I do. So yeah, I mean, I definitely should start to do that. But why do that when I can rely on my best friend and principal of Lone Star Capital to give me some eating tips?
Makes a lot of sense. So as far as restaurants and lineup and whatnot.
Yeah, the birthday lineup, let's hear it.
Yeah,
it's probably gonna be better than the Coachella lineup this year.
Yeah, very well could be. So tonight we are going to Carbone, which I know I've been accused of frequently going there, which is true, and it is good. Carbone does live up to the hype. It is a little hyped up. It is a little hype spot. You know, it's a sceney spot, but if you go early, it's not too loud, and the food's always super good. So Carbone tonight with the family. Super excited to show my mom, who has not been there yet, nor has my grandma.
Boosh is going?
Yeah, of course.
Perfect.
Yeah, so super excited to...
Is the chef and the owner of the restaurant going to come out and shake her hand and make sure she gets the white glove treatment that she deserves?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay, just that sushi.
But fingers crossed, when I walk in with my beautiful family, they'll go, oh, Rob, we've been expecting you. Please,
they'll hit you with the Nipsey.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully right. They come out, the manager comes out, gives me a little shake, and seats us right away. So, yeah, so Carbone tonight. And then I'm actually ordering pizza in tomorrow, which is Valentine's Day. So unfortunately, I don't have a Valentine's.
Ladies, if you're looking for someone who can really max out your IRR of life, here you go.
Love that plug. Yeah. So for Valentine's Day, we'll just stay home. You know, we don't need to go to the crowded restaurants and the prefix. And also one downside of my birthday.
By the way, I'm cooking my girlfriend dinner because I was like, I don't like this preset menu nonsense. We go out to eat enough. I take you out enough. I'll just make you something. But I'm not going and dealing with the nonsense, the bad service, the non-robust menus. No. I'll make you something. I can cook a little bit. So I haven't cooked actually all year. I haven't bought groceries from the grocery store all year. Not once have I bought groceries this year.
Wow.
Which is, yeah.
Well, I'm actually curious to get to the bottom of this whole Valentine's Day prefix thing. Like, obviously, restaurants well, obviously, but I believe restaurants do this for their benefit. I don't think it's for the public's benefit, for the diner's benefit, to have these prefix menus. I think basically restaurants expect to be more busy, and to accommodate the rush, they want to simplify their menu, and they can charge more because they know they have higher demand.
No, they know that if you're looking late, or just generally, that they can get a premium for that spot and that table that night, because if you've got a needier person and partner, then you're going to have to spend, you kind of get bamboozled into it. So they can get away with it. So it's kind of like, well, if you can kind of price gouge a bit, you know, subtly, you're going to price gouge subtly to accommodate that.
Yeah, I think that's what makes sense, but maybe there's another aspect to it why people do it. But so anyway, Wednesday, I'm trying out a new pizza spot right there on the corner of Canal Street, right there in Soho.
Where you can get a beautiful Rolex or Patek Philippe right there on the canal.
Yeah, that's where I get all my watches, on Canal.
For those who don't know, that's like the Mecca and capital of New York City, where you can find a knockoff or replica, as some would like to call it,
anything.
Of any designer piece or Swiss manufactured watch.
So yeah, this place is called, I think, Lucia or something like that. So I just walked by the other day and it smelled so good. So I just want to try a new pizza spot. I'm always looking for new good pizza spots. So yeah, that's what we're doing Wednesday. Then Thursday, we're going to Au Cheval, which is super exciting. Very good burger, very good Korean style chicken wings, like fried chicken thing. It's so good. We'll see how greedy things get at Au Cheval and if I'll do a root beer float. But that's the Thursday. And then Friday is, of course, Le Gratin. That is my little secret in the city. One of the best restaurants in the city. Not too busy, not too loud, always consistent. They once had a little bit too salty of mushrooms, but we let the manager know, no harm, no foul. And then also sometimes the dining room is a bit too hot because they're overheating it for the wintertime. But otherwise, one of my favorites.
Good to know. Well, with that said, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the Capital Spotlight Podcast. Yes. Rob and I will, in fact, be in Phoenix next week. So for Raise Fest, so if you are around in town and attending the event, please reach out to myself, as Rob and I are going to be filling out our calendar here shortly. And finally, on top of that as well, we will also be attending BEC in Salt Lake City in April. But before that, sorry, I'm out of order here. We're going to be having a mixer in Houston, I believe, on the 12th. So if you're interested in attending some of these events, or if you're going to be at any of these, please reach out to me. You know the email, but once more, it's craig@lscre.com, craig@lscre.com. Thank you so much for being here for another show of the Capital Spotlight Podcast, and I look forward to seeing you next week.